Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. If you have a question or comment about the topic today, you can find us at our website, www.idleredhands.com, or send us an email, info@idleredhands.com. Or find us on our Facebook, our G+ site, or our Twitter. All of those are at Idle Red Hands. Oh, and I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
How'd that work?
Yeah, all right. I was wondering. I was waiting for the I'm Chris, and I'm like, someone has to go first.
Right. I was getting cat shaking in front of the microphone.
Nice, oh, nice.
Right.
I'm Chris. I'm Wayne. I'm Lyle. I'm cat.
Meow.
No special guests this week, but I have finally started my Rifts game. But not mine, I guess, in the sense that I'm the game master, but I finally started a Rifts game.
Yeah!
You knew Chris was going to do that, didn't you?
You have to do something like that. I'd like to do a guitar riff, but I don't have a guitar, so.
And I'd like to do massive sigh. But yeah,
but it's fun. We're playing in the dinosaur swamp, for people that are familiar with Rifts. And for people who aren't, Atlanta.
Right, okay.
It's a swamp with dinosaurs.
Right, it doesn't matter where it actually is. All you need to say is dinosaur swamp. You're like, okay, I gotcha.
Much like the present-day Atlanta, actually.
So we actually recorded this episode prior to the month of interviews that we've had. So we decided to record a new introduction for the episode because we thought it'd be strange to not acknowledge that we had a series of interviews.
Especially since one of them connected to 13th Age.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, which is the topic for today, a camping confessions on 13th Age and a mini review of the 13th Age bestiary. But before we get into that, what do you guys think of the interviews overall?
I thought they were great. I really enjoyed doing them, despite having to do them at around 12 midnight our time.
I enjoyed them too, and we ended up pledging all four interviews that we did recently, as well as the original one we did, or the first one we did, a long time ago, and that was Emergence.
Right.
But prior to going into the interviews, I think we were only planning to pledge two of the five, and we ended up doing all five legitimately just because of the enthusiasm from the guests that we had.
Right.
Not only the enthusiasm, but the fact that they were able to explain things that we wanted to explain or get into some of the behind-the-scenes stuff, which makes you more excited, and you can really see how much care and attention went to these games.
Yeah, you know, like, I don't want to make it sound like they did a sales pitch or anything, but, man, they really sold their products well, and I'm really excited for all of them, for both the games and the designers.
Right. For me, it was a sales pitch, because, yeah, as Lyle said, I was, going into it, I was only prepared to back two of the Kickstarters, and at the end of, you know, at the end of the other two interviews, I'm like, wow, all right, I'm really sold on that game because of, as Lyle said, the enthusiasm, because they were able to answer our questions, and because they really sold the game and sold me on the idea that they'd put a lot of thought behind it.
Agreed.
So anyway, we just wanted to say that before getting into the episode proper. And by the time this uploads, I think only 13th Age in Glorantha and Southlands will still be live. And they'll only have a day or two left on them, or a couple days left on them. So if you're interested after listening to those interviews in those games, better hurry up.
Yeah, because Spirit of 77 and The Sprawl have already successfully funded.
Yes, they both successfully funded by the time we did the interview.
But yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, we had zero impact on it.
Oh, okay. If going from unsuccessful to successful, yeah, I think you can say zero.
Four out of the five interviews that we did, and the most recent four, were all successfully funded by the time they spoke to us, which is great that they made the time to speak to us.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we can claim credit for one stretch goal, and even that would be a stretch. Hey-o!
Nice. Yeah,
at least they got a few bucks from us. So.
Right. Hey, we're look at this way. We're 5 for 5. And does it really matter that we jumped on when they were already successfully funded? No. That's detail.
Not a lot, but I mean, again, it's a testament to their authors that they all did a really good job explaining and everything about their products. So, yay, guys!
Yeah. So, stay tuned for our next interview, D&D 5e. They're going to do well.
Fingers crossed for that one. Come on, Mike.
I'm guessing it's going to be a success.
Well, we got a review copy of the 13th Age Bestiary.
and then had to look up how to pronounce that word.
There was bestiary or bestiary, yeah.
Right. Turns out we were both right.
Well, it is a review copy, so what we'll do is we'll have a little bit of a review of the bestiary before we get into Campaign Confessions, which is, appropriately enough, about 13th Age. So what did you guys think of the bestiary?
I liked the art.
As did I. The monsters looked pretty cool.
Yeah, the goblins and the kobolds looked actually pretty scary.
Mm-hmm. And the dragons. Yeah. I love the way that they made the dragons. It reminded me of one of my old childhood favorite books, The Flight of Dragons. The art was really similar.
Yeah, I was really impressed with the look of the book. And it also helped us to understand some of the art that was in the original core book, which was lost on us. And I remember when we did review 13th Age, and we did have some comments about the style and the art, somebody did say that when you get the actual physical book or the print book, you'll appreciate it more, which was true. We did appreciate it more once we got it. But it took me a while. I think it wasn't until Wayne pointed out that the art used for the monsters was incorporating a tile system that's actually pretty important to how the game is run. And the bestiary spells it out quite clearly, where the tiles give some clue as to the monster's allegiance when it comes to the icons, mm-hmm. which is very important in 13th Age.
Right.
Yeah, I'll admit
right.
I didn't realize it until you mentioned it, Wayne.
Well, I didn't realize it until we wrapped up the campaign, and then I'm looking and I'm like, hey, these demon heads, they're kind of around this double triangle thing, and wait a minute, that's the same border as the Diabolist. Oh, I understand
now.
Right. So, yeah, a bit late. Yeah.
Yeah, and one of our comments when we reviewed the 13th Age core book was, in particular, about the monster section, is that, I mean, they had the tiles, and they were interesting style-wise, but we wanted to see more. We wanted to see depictions of the monsters. So the bestiary has that, mm-hmm. and then it actually having, like, drawings of the monster so people get a nice, clear idea of what it looks like, then the tiles actually add a lot to the game and add a lot to the style of the book, because now they have now that we understand what their function was, and we have like the best of both. We've got something very stylistic and functional, as well as something that, again, functional because it shows what they look like and also dresses up the book. So, yeah, so very pleased to see this.
Yeah, I still kind of stick to my opinion of in the previous book in that while the icons were all right, they, I really thirsted for that picture of the monster to help me imagine it in the game, and also as a resource to show to players. And I think that, yeah, in the bestiary, they're kind of doing a plus alpha. They're doing a lot of monsters have the tile icon as well as the full picture. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I wonder if the lack of monster illustrations in the core book was due to space issues, because I guess one of the benefits of the tiles is does take up less space. Mm-hmm. You can, put more text in the book and or keep the page count low. But the other thing is, talking about the icons and how big a deal they are, they're also very generic, which is what we said during the read-through review. And the reason the icons are generic is so that you can kind of play any fantasy game with this. And, there is a setting, but I wonder if the lack of monster images in the core book was so that they're not locking themselves into a certain style for monster, right? Like, you think about Pathfinder. Pathfinder goblins have those giant big melon heads and, kind of look a bit comical, but that's a Pathfinder goblin. Mm-hmm. The lack of there being, or the fact that there isn't a picture of a 13th Age goblin in the core book means you could use Pathfinder goblins if you wanted to, or you could use kind of the traditional, big nose, green skin, D&D goblins, or whatever kind of goblins you want, and the book doesn't say otherwise.
Well, no, I think it's a good point. Probably more the space issue than the other issue, but I think that there is some merit to it, because the bestiary does say that just because it says manticore and it's this, it doesn't mean it can't be. I think the example is antlion, something like that, or that kobolds can't be some sort of ninjas if you're doing a more Asian style or Japanese style game.
Mm-hmm.
They certainly want to make the monsters as useful as possible, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, I can certainly understand that, but yeah, definitely space. I mean, the bestiary is what, 244 pages, and the core book is 305 or something.
Mm-hmm.
The core book.
Right. And the core book has to cram, kind of the icons, character creation,
monster list and, you know, how to run a game all into one book. So
Yeah, there's a lot of things I liked about the best series. I liked the odd monster lists that were done that's at the beginning. And the lists were things like monsters that might negotiate or invoke a treaty.
Mm-hmm.
That's really good.
Yeah, monsters that cloak themselves in lies, monsters that might take you for ransom rather than just kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And lumping like about 5 or 6 monsters into each of these lists. And I think that really just helps you understand how to use them in the game.
Oh, yeah. They're really heavy on the fluff in this thing. Most of the monsters have adventure hooks to them and ideas, different ways to use them. They even have the title. They have kind of a in-fluff title for it. What was the one I really liked? I think it was the dragon. Yeah, here it is, the red dragon. It says a song of treasure. And it talks about their hordes and the way that they value things. And then, of course, it goes on into about Red Dragon's powers and abilities. Yeah, it's I think it's really well written.
Wasn't it the chimera that had extra abilities or tweaks based on whatever icon it was aligned with? It was either the chimera or the manticore. It was one of those ones where, you know, kind of the powers you could give it were based on the different icons.
Yeah, and with the other monsters as well, though, less so than the chimera where they get new powers, but at least they'll explain the relationships with the different icons.
Mm-hmm.
So, and for those people that are unfamiliar with 13th Age, and we'll certainly be discussing this a lot when we get into the rest of the episode, is icons are these archetypes, like the Dwarf King, the Elf Queen, the Archmage, just like classic powerful beings that you would commonly find in a fantasy realm,
mm-hmm.
Presented and also encouraged to use in your game. So the fact that, I mean, the players are encouraged to have relationships with these icons, so now they're also explaining how the monsters have relationships with these icons.
As they would.
Mm-hmm. And it might also be worth reiterating, too, we spoke of it when we did the read-through review, that the monsters are really easy compared to a lot of other systems, especially D20 systems. Their stats are, you know, a tiny box that's only 3 or 4 lines long, and then their powers outside of that. And there's not really that much information stuffed in there, so they're really easy to use and pull out on a moment's notice.
Yeah, I was wondering where you were going when you said the monsters are easy. I'm like, we ran into some tough ones in the campaign.
Not easy to kill, easy for the GM to run.
Right.
And they've continued to do that with the bestiary. What they've done, or what they've seemed to do, is just give more options.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in the core book, we just happened to use the Sahaguin a lot. Maybe we should check the pronunciation on that. So they give 2 variations of them. Whereas in the bestiary, you've got the Centaur, and you're looking at, 4 different types that you can use in your game. But for each one, the stat block is pretty compact. Easy to access, easy to reference, and certainly as the game master for 13th Age the first time around, I really appreciated that,
because mm-hmm.
you didn't want to be wading through too much stuff. It was enough where, I mean, you had all the core stats, but then you also have a couple special attacks and special abilities to kind of give it a little variety.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good.
Yeah, and they never felt any less involved than any monster I've fought in D&D or Pathfinder or whatnot.
Another common feature is a thing called building battles, which talks about how you would encounter them, a little bit about their ecology.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like, all in all, 2 thumbs up. It's one of the better bestiaries that I've ever seen.
Yeah, no, I definitely give this a positive review. I think it's really slick, really useful.
Well, I'm pretty sure they just recently put out 13 True Ways, which are kind of the, you know, other classes you would expect, things like, I know for a fact, like Monk and Druid are in there, you know, because those are the, I guess, iconic classes from the fantasy games that we didn't have in the core book. So I don't think there's any problem with, you know, Pellegrin Press not supporting 13th Age.
Well, to continue on our discussion of 13th Age, brings us to our next installment of Campaign Confessions. Those unfamiliar with Campaign Confessions, or those wondering how it differs from our review episodes, this is where we actually play the game. So the episodes are divided between our review of the system, and in this case, our updated review of the system, as well as our discussion of the actual game that we played, both what went well and what didn't go so well, and what we would have liked to have done differently. All right, well, so we start off with the 13th Age. So how does 13th Age compare now to when you reviewed it? It got a positive review from all three of us just reading the book.
Mm-hmm.
Still a positive review?
Absolutely.
Yes.
I think it succeeded. I hope this doesn't sound egotistical, but it pretty much went like I expected it to after reading the book. There were some places that seemed like they might be a little bit more difficult, and they were. There's some a lot of places that seemed like they would go really well, and they did. I mean, we'll get into the specifics later on, but I think, yeah, the playing it only increased my enjoyment for the game.
Yeah, I think if we were going to play a fantasy game again, my vote would be for 13th Age, just because as we said in the read-through review, it's kind of the best parts of Dungeons & Dragons 4th edition, 3rd edition, and a little bit of, I guess, story game tossed in there as well with the background. I think I would pick this over anything else, really.
I might too, yeah, actually, come to think of it.
I think of its nearest competitors at the moment, like a Pathfinder and Dungeons & Dragons, I would say I prefer this over the other two, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Wayne really made it raise a good point, because often we're talking about it being a hybrid of 3rd edition and 4th edition, but it does have a lot of narrative elements on top of that. It very much encourages you to just kind of play through stuff, and I'm not saying any role-playing game discourages that.
Right.
But certainly there's stuff in the system and in the game that encourages you to play it as opposed to roll it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, no, I was really pleased. As I was the game master, and we had three players, Wayne, Chris, and Yujiro. And certainly as the game master, I definitely appreciated, like, for example, what we talked about earlier, the abbreviated monster stats, which I found really helpful. And when there was a couple points in the game where I didn't really have the stats for the situation, but they're very, very easy to combine with something like the challenge rules in the game, or just taking something that they already have and just tweaking it.
Hmm.
So I found it really, really easy, even for maybe a newer game master.
Hmm.
This is definitely an accessible system.
I was wondering about that, because, yeah, we've said that the monster stat blocks are very compact. And so, yeah, I guess you answered my question there, Lyle, about if it made reskinning monsters easier than you know, prior experience with other systems, and it sounds like it does.
Did you do reskinning?
The sea serpent, or the
Plesiosaurus?
Yeah, that you guys encountered was actually just the stats for we call them the wyvern.
Oh, okay. Hmm.
Yeah.
Did not know at all.
Nope.
Didn't know at all.
All right, well, let's go back to character creation and talk about how you found that. Now, for a more step-by-step approach or explanation of the rules, please go back and listen to our review, our book read review of 13th Age. Here, we're going to give our like post-game impression.
Mm-hmm.
So how'd you find character creation?
Pretty easy in compared to the big competition, D&D and Pathfinder.
Huh. I was actually going to say a little bit tough, but not for any mechanical reasons. So, yeah, maybe opposite sides of the spectrum.
As a game master, I found the stuff that you provided, the actual stat stuff, was pretty easy to wade through.
Mm-hmm.
Things that were a challenge, one thing that's part of 13th Age is the one unique thing.
Mm-hmm.
And as well as the relationships with the icons, which we'll discuss when we talk about gameplay a little bit more. Yeah, the one unique thing was a bit challenging as a game master, in the sense that it really encourages the players to think of something special about their characters.
Right.
But we had only planned this as a short campaign, and trying to think of how to incorporate these three unique things into the game is a challenge. And as a game master, I would perhaps say don't necessarily try to work them all in. It certainly lends itself more to a longer campaign than a short campaign or a short adventure.
Right, right.
In fact, in a short adventure, you might not be able to incorporate any of them. but the game certainly encourages you to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But even, I guess, if you can do it as a game master, I guess it gets the players thinking more deeply about their characters. And right. Is that how you found it, or did you find it was a bit of a chore?
Mine was hard. Like I couldn't think of anything. In the end, I just gave up and I just gave a present to you. My one unique thing was my spells occasionally go very well or very poorly, depending on the game situation. Yeah.
Just to say, Chris was playing a wizard.
Yes, yes.
So, we didn't mention, our characters were sixth level. So we didn't start at level one. You know, the idea for the game while was setting up was that we were kind of established, you know, characters in the world, so we started at sixth level. Lyle saying that, and you too, Chris, saying that you got stuck for your one unique thing. It was the one unique thing and the backgrounds that take the place of skills in 13th Age that I was drawing a blank on at first, which is why I said character creation was kind of difficult, because you can essentially do anything you want with those backgrounds and your one unique thing. And I ran into a bit of the blank page syndrome, the analysis paralysis. I can choose anything I want, and so I don't know what to choose. Mm. So I played a sorcerer. The one unique thing I picked was I stole the red's fire, and he wants it back. Only because when I was looking through the sorcerer's spells, it said that there is no spells associated with the red because he hasn't given his power to anybody. And I thought, okay, you know, one unique thing is a way to make your character unique and special, and so I'm going to be the only sorcerer able to cast the red spells. Didn't really come up in play, but possibly because, as Lyle said, with kind of a shorter game, it's more difficult to get that into play, but also me as a player, I didn't really push for it.
Actually, the person's unique thing that I was able to draw on was Yudro, mm-hmm. who's not here for the episode. And his was related to the Dwarf King, and what was that he had the key to the Hall of Vengeance? Or
right.
Something where the Dwarf King can't access, and that has the Axe of the Seven Bloods. And this is in the icon profile, so that was interesting. And just like Wayne was saying, is like he drew his one unique thing from information that's actually in the book. So that was good. But yeah, it was difficult to incorporate them all without getting like a very, very crowded Secret Wars-esque, you know, comic book reference kind of gathering of icons.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we did use one person's one unique thing.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why I opted for sixth level was, players were, or the characters were more established in the world, but also to test the system so we could try or have access to more powers and abilities and to see how those would work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did not mind playing at sixth level at all. I would wonder what playing at first level felt, because I never felt like I ran out of options in this, you know, during this game. I wonder if that would happen at first level.
And actually, and to jump in on that, I never felt overwhelmed with options like I did when making a Pathfinder character.
That's very true. That's very true. Things were very streamlined and kind of pretty, not simple, because that kind of has a negative connotation, but yeah, I too never felt overwhelmed with choices I had to make.
I don't want to say that this is a weakness of the system, because I really don't think it is, but it is definitely different that someone who's coming from D&D, especially 4E or Pathfinder, they might feel a little bit option-starved, because creating a character in those other systems is incredibly fiddly, and it's a good kind of fiddly. I really enjoy, you know, getting down and really being able to work the character and all the different kinds of numbers and options you can pull in, and even though it's still the same kind of game, this 13th Age doesn't offer the same amount of options to it. So some people might be put off by that. I definitely wasn't, because Pathfinder was too much for me. But yeah,
I know what you're saying. With the backgrounds that you can choose, which take the place of skills in like a Pathfinder or a 3.5 Dungeons and Dragons game, Like, my backgrounds were secret police of the blue, fiend hunter, and soldier. And I divided up to 10 points between that. And there are not as many mechanical options as, you know, someone coming from D&D 4E would think, but the way 13th Age is set up is if that background would come into play, you get to add that bonus to your skill check. So, I think it's a different mindset. You know, you kind of have to shift what you're expecting. And then once you do that, and this is why I say it's, you know, has elements of a more narrative game in it, whatever the Secret Police of the Blue means, you get that bonus. You can do things related to that background. Whereas, you know, games that are more mechanically based, you would need to take like a feat or do a specific kind of action to get a specific bonus.
Yeah, I think we all stretched our backgrounds at some points to try and get them to fit whatever the thing was. But you know what? It was great. It was actually really fun to be able to do. So.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the point I wanted to raise. And just to emphasize that we are actually a group of friends that interact outside of gaming as well, or
in spite of.
Well, we're not like strangers that come in just for the game, so maybe need more rules to fence us in and to make it easier on the game master. There was never a point where I felt the players abused the backgrounds to try to get like a cheap bonus to a role. There were a couple moments, or there were a couple times in the game where someone would try something. One that comes to mind, Wayne, was your expertise with the demonic.
Right.
And it really just, it didn't slow down the game or anything. I would just say, well, do you have this experience because you read it in a book? Or do you have this experience because you actually encountered them? And we're trying to determine which ability to use or to act as the base. Right. And then just the quick answer, and then it's, okay, there's your roll. So roll it. Yeah, so everybody was very reasonable about it, but we always try to be reasonable with each other in games.
Out of game, where all bets are off. Yeah.
Yeah. True.
So I would be interested to see how this plays with people that you're not too familiar with and with people who are either rules lawyers or power gamers, and to see if they try to break that. But certainly if you have everybody that's there to have fun and are there to just tell a good story, then it was certainly enough rules.
Yeah.
13th Age definitely relies more on the social contract between players rather, you know, with the players being able to adjudicate rules themselves in some places, such as, you know, skills and backgrounds and the one unique thing, where other games rely more on mechanics to make sure things are fair and even. And as Lyle said, if your group needs that mechanical fairness, I wonder if you would run into trouble playing 13th Age.
I think you would. Just the game master would have to make more rulings. In the game, I made very few rulings, so to speak, and just consulted with the players to think, okay, what do you think is the best background, for example, in this situation? Or towards the end of the game, and it became quite important, how to use a certain ritual.
Right.
And would this ritual work? And the players were able to come up with a pretty plausible explanation why it would work, so sure.
Which then almost didn't get pulled off.
Yeah, we'll get to that a little bit later. But I you know, this reminds me of the interview that we did with Hamish Cameron talking about the sprawl. And he's saying one thing he liked about Apocalypse World, it was very much, you know, the game master being fans of the players. And I think 13th Age is a system that allows the game master and encourages the game master to be fans of the players. So, yeah, so certainly with character creation. And I actually statted out a few, even though it was great using the monsters and the limited stats, there was a few characters that I wanted to be a little bit more in depth. We didn't encounter them all, but so I had to make up some quick characters.
Was it quick to do so?
Yeah, it was pretty good, and especially if you're only making them as NPCs, you don't you know, you fudge things a little bit. But I tried to follow the, or I did follow the actual game rules. There's the same rules that the players would follow, just so I can also have that experience and nothing was unfair.
Hmm.
But yeah, it was pretty easy to do and just dash them out. I found a lot of fun with the choices. I can see what Chris and Wayne are talking about, where it's less of a, here's a list, go. It's more, okay, you've chosen this. Now here are your paths. Which way do you want to go?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now you made your characters. Sorry, and Yujiro made a
dwarf fighter.
A dwarven fighter, who was pretty lethal.
Yeah.
And pretty solid. So now that you made the characters, how'd you find that the game actually played?
Pretty easily. You know, things are streamlined, it's straightforward. Pretty much all your roles, you know, to do things are D20 plus level plus stat bonus.
Mm-hmm.
Plus the escalation die, and I guess any other bonuses if you're fighting. So, I mean, it's a D20 system. So that made it pretty easy to remember. Of course, it took a little bit of getting used to at the beginning, like, oh, I forgot to add an escalation die, or, you know, oh, I forgot to add in this power. But that was more
I forgot that I had my teleport for the whole game.
right. Good one, Chris. Yeah. Meanwhile, anyway. So it was a little bit more just learning a new system rather than the system being difficult at all. One of the things that was a little bit tricky, for me at least, sometimes the combats were tough to visualize. You know, 13th Age doesn't require you to use a grid. It just kind of abstractly tracks where combatants are. You're either, you know, engaged, near, or far, I believe.
Yeah.
And what you can do at those different range bands are different. But I liked the abstract nature, and I liked not having to count squares or, you know, do measurements exactly. And you just kind of assume that everybody in the combat is, you know, within near distance of each other, and therefore you can affect each other, unless mm-hmm. you say you are moving away from the combat, in which case you are now far away. However, when the more complicated or involved battles came up, it was a little bit tricky to kind of visualize where everybody was. And that's not really a fault of the system, maybe more a result of how we were playing, which was mostly voice only.
Yeah, it's a good time to bring up the tools we were using. We were using Skype as well as Roll20. Now, we did, at the beginning, try to do verbal only, very old school style of combat. And the feedback was it was hard to visualize. Now, 13th Age has a thing called position, and that's what Wayne talked about, like engage, nearby, far. And although that's very, very simple and sounds very simple, it probably messed me up the most as a game master. Like, you say, okay, now you're here. Did I say you were near?
Right.
Yeah. So, and for one thing that I thought would be a lot easier than it was, and I think this was just me, not necessarily the system, was the matter of position. Later on in the game, we did incorporate the mat in Roll20. Just to show a general position of the characters, as well as the monsters or the antagonists.
I wonder if, and you know, hindsight being 2020, I wonder if just a very abstract map with like two concentric circles, one that says far away and one that says near, would be all you really need. You know, all the guys in the inner circle are nearby to each other and can, you know, move around and interact with each other, while all the tokens or creatures in the outer concentric circle are far away from each other.
I think we talked about that, but we said it wouldn't work because each different character would have to have their own circles because the characters aren't always together.
I was going to say that, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I think it would work if all you were doing is just saying, okay, I'm near, and you were going to cast your spells or wail on them with your weapon. But if you wanted to interact with the environment, then that would be tough to do.
Right.
I think, for example, we had an encounter with a black pudding. And that would have worked because it was just one thing.
Right.
And I mean, sure, there was the environment, there was trees around and things like that. But I know when there was in that ruined dwarven hall, there was like pillars that you could use. There were different doorways. Mm. The antagonists were split up and in different locations, yeah, as well as the group was split up. So there, what we used was probably the best. If we had added circles as well, then that would have been fine, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't know if it would have gotten confusing.
Yeah.
There was a moment where, even with the battle map, people got confused, like which doorway they were in front of.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
I can see what you're saying from a GM's perspective, how it must have been difficult to keep track of everything, but I actually have no complaints from a player's perspective. I quite enjoyed it, actually. It was really nice to not worry about the squares and just think more dramatically about what kind of actions I want to be taking. And though it occasionally got confusing, it was always easily solved by just asking the GM, wait, where's that guy again? So, I understand that puts more pressure on you as a GM, but from a player's perspective, no problems at all for me.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Chris, because I didn't want it to sound as if I didn't like what 13th Age did. As a player, I did like worrying more about the dramatic effects of what I was doing, or if this was a movie, what would be happening right now? And, you know, the system using these range bands maybe not encourages you, but definitely allows you to think that way, rather than having to count squares and say, oh, I'm one square short, therefore I will not make that, you know, heroic bull rush attempt, even right, though that's what my character would do. Where, yes, I liked the simplicity of the 13th Age movement system. There were a few times where, as you said, we did have to stop and ask Lyle, wait a minute, where is that guy exactly? Are we near or are we far from that guy? But mm-hmm, I don't feel as if it messed up the game or drew you out of the narrative. I certainly liked it much better than counting squares on a battle map. Mm-hmm.
And I think that worked. And also it was one of the later combats, so we're more comfortable with the system.
Right.
Is the one that took place in the water, mm-hmm, when you were all on these little ice rafts. I'm sure Chris will explain that later.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there was that like sea monster that was attacking you, where it's underwater, you're above water, like you don't need to know squares.
Mm-hmm.
You also want a little bit of the element, where is it?
Yeah,
what
yeah,
can I see? How well can I see it? So that was really good. Like, who's engaged? Like, which boat is engaged? Am I near that boat or am I far away from that boat?
Right.
So in a combat like that, that was more unusual, I think definitely this was superior to counting squares.
And I think the imprecise location of it really added to that scene, because it kind of built that, oh no, where is it? Where's it going to come from next kind of a feeling to the combat.
Well, it was also kind of, I talked about that heroic thing before, and as the character who dove into the water to try and unsuccessfully save one of these, you know, guys, NPCs from this tentacle monster thing, in another game, I might not have done that, because there would be, you know, okay, how deep can you dive? How many, you know, squares of depth can you cover? Other stuff like that, where, the system made it so I could say, screw it, I'm diving in after that guy, and I kind of know I'm going to be able to get where I can do something heroic.
It encourages drama, both good and bad.
Right, right.
Well, as long as we're talking about some of the things that were good and bad, one of the things that I found a little bit fiddly in the game was actually the making the skill checks. I really did like the background system, as we discussed before, but this was something that I thought during the read-through as well, that when you make a skill check, it's a formula of a d20 plus the relevant ability modifier plus the level plus the number of points in the relevant background versus a DC set by the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit of a long formula, though it works very well for the game. But each time you want to make a background check, it requires double-checking with the game master, in that you have to check what the relevant ability modifier is going to be, and also whether or not your background is going to be okay to use for it. So it's not, I think it worked well, and again, it encouraged a lot of dramatic play, but it was a little bit gamey, maybe, is the way to say it, that it kind of took me a little bit out of the suspense each time to have to add it up. And also because we were new to the game, I had to look up the formula every time, too.
I kind of, you know, had to remind myself of the formula, even though it's like, okay, D20 plus modifier plus skill, you know. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, I might disagree with you where it didn't take me out of the game any more than building your dice pool in Marvel Heroic or in, you know, a New World of Darkness game, you know. You kind of, it's different from a game where the six abilities have definite linked skills.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, you say, I have this background. Here's how I'm trying to use that. Does that make sense to you, the GM? And then the GM either says yes, or the GM says no, and you either find a new, you know, a new skill,
or a new GM,
or you know, you rise your statement, and then there's a little bit of, okay, this is the thing I'm doing. Would that be this stat? And again, the GM is either going to say yes or no. So it's similar to other games where, yeah, I wasn't bothered by it at all.
Okay. Yeah, and I don't really want to make out like I was really bothered. Just that was one of the few criticisms I had of the game.
Well, again, it's a different mindset from coming from a game like Pathfinder where your skill list says, you know, animal handling is always used with charisma, you know, mm-hmm. or
yeah.
you know, whatever skill is always used with this stat. It's just different, and it's something to get used to.
Mm-hmm. Very true, very true. Besides that, some of the other unique features of the game, I really like the escalation die, though I forgot about it almost every single combat.
Yep.
Yeah, but it was very nice. We, as we discussed in the reading review, we thought it was good because the longer combat went on, the more it was able to build up to help the combat finish more quickly.
Right.
So that was good.
No, I was a sorcerer, and as I said before, and I liked the way the spells worked, because they got better the higher level you were, and I liked the recharge mechanic. Basically, some spells are at will, you know, kind of once per day or per encounter, similar to 4th edition, but some spells have a recovery number, and after the battle, so long as you roll that number or higher, you get the spell back. So that was kind of fun, and I went with the dragon mage, where the breath weapon spells, once I used them in a battle, I had to roll a die at the beginning of each of my turns, and on a certain number they would come back, but I could only use them that turn, then I'd have to roll again. So, I don't know, that was fun, kind of never really knowing what spell I would have available, and trying to sometimes make the best of a bad situation, or like, oh yeah, just when I wanted that spell to come back, here it is, you know, let's use it. So, yeah, mm-hmm. I enjoyed that.
I guess if 13th Age has a signature rule, or a signature system, it's the icons. How did you think that worked? So how it works is you have a certain amount of points, and you spend them to determine what relationship you have to certain icons.
Right, right.
And then those points equate to a number of dice you get to roll, number of d6 that you get to roll.
Right. So you can either assign these points in relationship to a positive, negative, or conflicted relationship with, you know, an icon. And if you're playing kind of heroic characters, you can have at most one point of a positive relationship with an evil icon, and I think unlimited number of points put in a neutral or good icon. And they say that the higher the number of relationship points you have with the icon, the more useful the relationship is, not the closer you are to the icon. You know, it could still be a very, you know, the Dwarf King could hate your guts, but for some reason he would always lend you aid if you had a high relationship, you know, with the Dwarf King. But I like the idea. I think much like One Unique Thing, it seemed hard to implement in a shorter game, or it required a lot more improvisation on your part as GM, Lyle.
Mm-hmm. And the idea is that the players would roll these at the beginning of the session, although there's the option to roll it at the end of the session and give the game master some time to think about how these would come into effect.
Right.
And
we started with rolling at the beginning of the session, didn't we?
Yeah, And we were actually playing pretty short sessions, under 3 hours. Mm-hmm. And it was really hard to incorporate them all for a couple reasons. One, because the session was so short. Two, it was very mobile. Mm-hmm. So the people weren't in a city interacting, so then you build up relationships. They were pretty much in a race to reach a certain place by a certain period of time.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So there wasn't...
Would have felt very artificial if each session, it's like, oh, and you just happen upon, you know, an emissary from, you know, the Elf Queen.
Yeah.
Walking this way, because that would happen every session since we were so mobile.
Or mm-hmm. or there's like a magic item that is related to the Elf Queen and the players find that. Some ways that we try to do it, for example, Wayne rolled well for the Great Gold Worm, fights demons. And what happened is in that session, he was able to get a special bonus when he drew power for his abilities.
Right.
Yujiro rolled well for his relationship with the Dwarf King, which was a complicated relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And that became more story-driven, so I created this thing called the Underroad, which was under this mountain and had been abandoned for centuries, but the Dwarf King has just recently reopened it, and it gave the party another option, another way to go. Yeah, so different things. Chris rolled well with the High Druid, who he has a good relationship with. So I had this sorceress character who also has a relationship with the High Druid provide assistance, but I think he
yeah,
rolled
a lot of help.
I think he rolled it was a complicated roll, so there was a catch to that, and the players turned it down. But even with that, it was still hard to think of stuff for every session. Again, probably because the sessions were so short. So I initially tried to do it, okay, it's one game day.
Right.
We'll do the rolls, and then at a certain point I said, guys, this will be your last roll. And we will try to work these in before the end of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was fine.
Yeah, and I think that might be something is don't do sessions, but maybe do acts of your story and have the players roll at the beginning of an act.
Yes. That's actually the exact suggestion that I was going to have. Because
oh, okay.
I thought your choice to just stop doing them at a certain point in the story was hands down the right choice to make. Because the story had a certain amount of momentum going at that time, and we were closing in on the goal and also the end of the short. And it would have just been odd, and I think not as enjoyable, if you had broken up that, you know, that last session or two just to squeeze in an icon roll. I think it better served the story. So, yeah, I think doing it on, I was going to say like on an arc basis, but on an act basis is probably a really good way of going about it.
That's one way to do it, and again, I was totally okay with Lyle saying, and this is, you know, the last icon roll of the game, specifically for the same reasons you said, Chris, because, you know, kind of the end of the arc. Another way to do it would be if you know what type of game you're going to play, and I'm pretty sure you went into this game with a fairly clear, you know, timeline of what was going to happen, Lyle, because, you know, no GM can predict what their players are going to do. But if you're playing a game where you know the basic plot line, maybe limit the icons that the players or that the characters can have relationships with. Say, this is what the game's about. It makes sense to have relationships with these icons and narrow it down from the 13 that exist in the setting to maybe 5 or 6 or 7. So that way you as the game master can figure out, you know, okay, you know, along the path, these are some, you know, boons or some, you know, bonuses with catches that might come up if the rolls happen, or at least, you know, you won't be completely flummoxed about how to work the Prince of Shadows into this campaign because one of your players rolled a 6 with mm-hmm. their relationship.
Yeah, I think the icons lend really well to a sandbox-style game where you don't have a planned story, so they can give you that next hook for the players to work on. But, yeah, I think, you know, it's your game, so feel free to use them or not as necessary.
Oh, definitely. I think the limits that Wayne is suggesting is great for certainly the style of game that we played,
mm-hmm.
which is very limited, had a limited number of icons that were real players. Certainly the roles that the players made did encourage me to do things that I hadn't planned. So that was great. A more open thing, or like a sandboxy thing, like Chris said, is better for a campaign and just say, well, whatever, but it'll come up at certain points. And you might even make the roles, you know, like Chris says, arc-based. I said act-based, or you might even do it at significant locations. And I guess that could be like scenes and that. But okay, when you're in the city, okay, make a roll. All right. And that'll be it until you go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I could see that. Yeah.
And you could even have like a dungeon, and the dungeon can be really scary because you say, no, icons aren't going to help you here. And don't allow the players, like even if you said location based and say, okay, we're at the dungeon, we're going to make a roll. No, even the icons have no power here. And that might make the dungeon seem a little bit scarier, but it certainly...
All players turn around.
Right. Okay, let's go back to that other
location. You
don't have
the dwarf king sitting there, oh, hey! Adriel, fancy meeting you here.
Right.
I just thought I'd give you this axe.
Yeah.
Help you through. It's gotten me through some tight spots. Yeah. And of course, it's an exaggeration. Again, the book provides like really subtle or less intrusive ways to incorporate the icons, but still... If you're doing like really short sessions, it can be really tough to incorporate them. So think about what would work for you. So there's a few suggestions there.
Yeah.
But overall, I did like the idea of the icons, and it certainly helped shape the story. I find it creates, or it's better for a bigger story.
Yes.
Because of the icons, but maybe just with, you know, once we settle, you know, maybe because... You're running 13th Age for the first time, so then you're like, I want to use the icons and I want it to matter. So then it pushes you towards a bigger story. And then once you kind of get that out of your system, then you can work with the icons in a more understated way, especially if you're like first level characters or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of the elements in the game are really helpful towards a longer running campaign, specifically the icon roles, the unique thing, and the, what was it, quirks, I think they're called, which are little behavioral things that get attached to magical items. For example, if you have the Boots of Elvenkind, they make you love elven poetry. I think those things can really give a lot of ideas and juice towards a longer campaign, to, especially if you're doing a sandbox kind of thing. But they can be really tough to incorporate into a shorter one like we did.
Maybe because I was reading the Fate core book, I kind of see it. Like, if you're going to do a shorter game, maybe have everybody sit down and either the GM says, this is the type of game, these are the type of things that would be appropriate, so let's, you know, kind of rein ourselves in a little bit here, and then he or she can say, sorry, that's not appropriate, how about you tweak it this way to better fit, you know, kind of the game we'll be playing. Or the GM looks and says, okay, these are the types of characters I'm getting, therefore, I'm going to need to kind of, you know, rearrange some stuff.
Right.
So.
And I think after more experience with the game, you would know better what you can leave out and what you can keep in and such.
And that brings us to the end of the system part of Campaign Confessions, which is about 13th Age. So as a system, what did you guys think?
Definitely 2 thumbs up.
Oh, yeah. We all thought it looked really good in the read-through, and it turned out to be really good. It delivered on its promises. So, yeah, it's great. 2 thumbs up.
Surprised you didn't give 3, Chris.
If I had 3, I would. I'm sticking my toes up right now.
All right.
Are you missing a toe? Or?
No, that didn't work out either.
Definitely strongly recommend the system and the book.
Mm-hmm.
And next week, we'll be posting up part 2 of this Campaign Confessions, which will focus on the actual game that we played.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher, or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can plus one us on G+, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in our forums. Those are at idleredhands.com/forums, and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or you can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com. Thanks a lot, and see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Drive-through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-through RPG. The one true source for RPGs.
IdleRedHands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.